Well, no one ever carried me or gave me the best place or held me in the carriages or over the mill race. No one's ever done for me, but look at me now to my face, and ain't I a woman? Look at me, look at my arms. I have plowed and planted and gathered into bonds, and no one that beside me could work so hard for last as long. And ain't I a woman? And ain't I a woman? Good.
And for the last well, I stand no more on auction blocks or on a pedestal. I do it for just one, trying nothing more to tell. And ain't I a woman? Ain't I a woman?
That's the music of the Deadly Nightshade. The words were written extemporaneously, probably a long time ago, by Sojourner Truth. They move me every time I hear them. I am Judy Pasternak, and the program is More Than Half the World. And before anything else, I have to give you a hard luck story. This is by way of putting my thumb out. The members of the women's department here would like to go to Houston in November for the International Women's Year Conference. The commercial media are sending hordes of reporters, photographers. I know a woman photographer who's going for several different publications, most of them small. Everybody is sending people to Houston. It's going to be a very important event. And those commercial media are not generally feminist media. We would like to be able to bring you a feminist, woman-identified report of what happens in Houston, and we don't have the money. So we are asking something, I guess, that we have never done before. I think it's been done on rare occasions before by the station. We are asking you to send a group of women from the WBAI Women's Department to Houston by providing us with the wherewithal, by sending money, donations, and this is special, so if you want to, listen carefully. It's not the usual routine for sending money to the station. You would send a check made out to Pacifica WBAI Women's Department. The Pacifica part makes it tax deductible. And you mail it, not to the address we sometimes give you, but to WBAI, Attention Women's Department, at 359 East 62nd Street, New York 10021. And you can put put a note in there that that is to send a woman to Houston. It's going to cost probably the best part of $500, I think, to send more than one person from here there. That is, if someone doesn't fly, if we go by car, it's virtually the same amount of money whether we send two or four. And we're asking you for help. So we will be thrilled if you do it, if you get us there. We would have to have the money fairly soon so that we can make plans to do it, because right now we really, if we don't get there with your help, we're probably not going to get there. I hope we hear from you. I don't know right now who the Women's Department is sending. Probably not me. People are going to have to be here holding the fort too. But I want to know that I'm going to be getting a real firsthand account of what goes on. It's going to be, I guess I should remind you, those of you who don't know, it's going to be a very important event in the history of this decade of feminism. Because, I better run through what it is for people who don't know. During the International Women's Year Conference in Mexico in 76, there were declarations made by different countries about how much they were spending on women's affairs and small, underdeveloped third world countries, what we call underdeveloped, were spending $1 million, $2 million. And the United States delegate announced that the United States was spending $5,000. And after that, Bella Abzug initiated legislation providing for a series of conferences in each state which would make resolutions addressing the needs of women, saying what the women in every state felt the government should be doing. President Carter has made a commitment to listen to the report that comes out of this, and that final thing is going to happen in Houston on November 18th through 21st, where women who were elected as delegates to that convention from the different state conferences go and hammer out a series of resolutions about what things that the government should be addressing, what women's concerns the government should be addressing in this country. And there has been a lot of controversy. Most, you know, the feminists in the country think that one important thing is the Equal Rights Amendment, and there's a lot of feeling against it, and there have been delegations elected with anti-ERA platforms. There have been delegations elected from some states with anti-abortion platforms. I think the delegation from Mississippi is going there with an anti-welfare platform as well. And the results will be a statement, at least theoretically, of what the women in this country care about and are interested in. And if you want to know not only what the final list of resolutions is, but what happened to make that list come out the way it comes out in November, we will broadcast it if we have someone there to cover it. Okay, one more time. The checks would be made out to Pacifica WBAI Women's Department and mailed to Women's Department, WBAI, 359 East 62nd Street, New York. Now back to our program.
Well, I tried to be the kind of wanted me to be, and it's not your fault that I tried to be what I thought you wanted to see. Smiling face, shining hair, clothes that I thought you'd like me to wear, made to please and not to tease. It's the custom-made woman blues.
This is the entire text of a letter that Viv Sutherland received from the Acupuncture Center. Dear Ms. Sutherland, acupuncture facelifts are the newest adaptation of the ancient Chinese art of acupuncture. It is a non-surgical, inexpensive method of smoothing, firming, and toning the skin, and the results are truly amazing. If you are planning a program on cosmetic surgery or rejuvenation, you might consider including the benefits of facial acupuncture. Our medical director, Dr. Ralph Sepson, our clinical psychologist, Mickey Tatum, and the chief acupuncturist, Dr. Lucia Luck, are available for interviews. I have enclosed a copy of a recent press release that will give you further information on acupuncture facelifts. If I can be of help to you, please do not hesitate to call. Sincerely, Information Director, the Acupuncture Center.
All guaranteed to keep a hold of your man, made to please and not to tease. It's the custom-made woman blue. I learned so young were nothing but lies. Make to please and not to tease. It's the custom-made woman blues. Make to please and not to tease. It's the custom-made woman blues.
Acupuncture facelifts. That's a new twist. I guess they always find ways to turn us into objects. I'm not going to be talking about women as objects today. I'm going to be talking about women as workers, and specifically sharing some things that women have written about our lives as workers with you. And I thought it would be appropriate to start with the prologue from Barbara Wertheimer's book, We Were There, The Story of Working Women in America. The prologue is called The First American Women. And it starts with a poem, a Native American poem. Oh, our mother the earth, oh, our father the sky, your children are we, and with tired backs we bring you the gifts you love. Then weave for us a garment of brightness. May the warp be the white light of morning. May the weft be the red light of evening. May the fringes be the falling rain. May the border be the standing rainbow. Thus weave for us a garment of brightness, that we may walk fittingly where birds sing, that we may walk fittingly where grass is green, O our mother the earth, O our father the sky. That's from the Song of the Sky Loom. She walked softly and straight in her deerskin moccasins, returning to the village after a day of planting corn. Her young child slept in his cradle board on her back, having spent most of the day hanging on a nearby tree limb while she worked. A member of one of hundreds of Native American tribes scattered across the length and breadth of the continent, she lived much as her ancestors had lived for more than 20,000 years. Indian tribal life, though it varied widely, always harmonized with nature. The Indian philosophy was to till the land they needed, to fish and hunt to supply their basic wants. They believed that the land was only entrusted to their care during their time on this earth. They knew how much they depended on the lakes and streams and forests, and were careful not to take too much and to waste nothing, lest in anger the Great Spirit punish them for their greed. There was plenty of land. When crop yields told them that the land needed a rest, they cleared new fields and moved on. The first working women in America were Indian women, resourceful in utilizing every aspect of their environment to sustain life. They gathered wild plants for food, herbs for medicines and dyes, clay from the riverbed for pottery, bark and reeds for weaving cloth, clamshells for jewelry, and wampum. While men hunted and fished, fought wars, built canoes and longboats, wigwams and hogans, and made weapons for the hunt, women tilled the soil and sowed the seed, cultivated and harvested, wove baskets and blankets, tanned animal hides and made clothing, cured meats and dried vegetables, cared for the children, and maintained the home, which they sometimes also built. Indian women were the first people we know who cultivated corn or made maple sugar. They grew cotton, pumpkins, beans, squash, melons, and tobacco. Not long after his arrival in Jamestown in 1607, Captain John Smith noted how hard the Indian women worked. They always seemed busy, while Indian men had time for talking, games, and tribal governance. Agriculture, so important to the tribes, was usually the responsibility of the women, and under their supervision. Thus they could and did play a key role in tribal decision-making and barter. Among the Shawnee of the Middle West, women could be chiefs, and exerted a peaceful influence, helping the tribe avoid unnecessary bloodshed. A woman in the front lines of an Indian war party served to remind the enemy to spare the helpless. Women's councils among the Cherokee of the Southeast had considerable power, and on occasion overruled a chief if they felt he was angering the Great Spirit. New village chiefs were nominated by the women of the tribe. Among tribes such as the Nez Perce of the Far West, men and women had equal rights in cases of divorce, which assumed equal division of property. Clans such as the Seri of Lower California were matrilineal. Executive power was held by the brothers of the principal woman, and elder women controlled clan property. Iroquois women of the Northeast controlled and guarded the public treasury and other tribal property, and could be medicine women, sachems, or chieftainesses. Judith K. Brown describes the important role of Iroquois women. Iroquois agricultural activities, which yielded bountiful harvests, were highly organized under elected female leadership. Iroquois women maintained the right to distribute and dispense all food, even that procured by the men. This was especially significant as stored food constituted one of the major forms of wealth for the tribe. Through their control of the economic organization of the tribe, Iroquois matrons were able to make available or to withhold food for meetings of the council and for war parties, for the observance of religious festivals, and for the daily meals of the household. These economic realities were institutionalized in the matron's power to nominate council elders and to influence council decisions. They had a voice in the conduct of war and the establishment of treaties. Despite their central position in the economy, however, Indian women did not have the status of men, nor were they considered men's equals. Highest glory lay in the hunt and in war, and here men could achieve fame in activities not open to women. One of the few tribes in which women did exert unusual influence was the Zuni, a wholly agricultural people. Zuni men worked the fields, whereas the women were considered the proprietors of the land itself. There was little hunting or warfare. Reversing another traditional pattern, husbands came to live with their wives' families. Indian women assumed almost total responsibility for childcare, and their infants were with them constantly. Children played together until they were 7 or 8 years old, but at that age role differentiation began, and boys began to play with each other in imitation of the hunt, sometimes going out with the men, while girls stayed with their mothers to learn the skills they would need as women. When they reached their teens, boys and girls were ready for initiation into the adult life of the village, which often involved solemn rituals or tests of bravery. Boys who could not pass these tests found themselves assigned, together with the old men, to farm under the direction of the women. Although a few names of individual women have come down to us, their help was critical for the survival of the early European settlers and explorers. They shared their knowledge of agriculture and the gathering and preparation of herbal medicines, teaching the settlers from English towns and cities how to farm the rocky New England soil, what to plant, how to soften deerskin for clothing, how to backpack babies, how to make utensils from gourds and shells, and indeed, the lore of survival in the wilderness.
The work of the
This is from a book called Woman's Work. It's the transcription of an interview with a young British housewife named Patricia Andrews. It's important that you know it's British because there are slightly different vocabulary things. This one will be 2 in the summer and the other one will be 5. She goes to school all day. I was 18 when we got married. My parents didn't want me to get married. They thought I was too young. But my sister was 18 when she got married, and so was my mother, so they didn't have a leg to stand on, really. We were going to wait 7 years for a baby. 3 months after we got married, I got pregnant with Kara. I left school at 15. I wanted to be a nurse or an air hostess, but I didn't do any of those things because I left school and I hadn't done any O-levels or anything. All I did was this course in typing. My first job was as a telephonist and typist. It was a junior post, really. Junior clerk, it was called. I didn't like that job. I was washing up and making toast more than anything. Pat, get this, get that, get us another cup of coffee. It was like that all the time. I left there and went into a factory to get my money to get engaged, to save up for getting married because the money wasn't good enough. I enjoyed the work at the factory, though I thought I'd never get it at first. I was wiring up fluorescent signs, you know, the ones that hang outside shops. It took about a fortnight to learn. Yes, I quite enjoyed the factory, although I'd never wanted to go into one. It was something different. The atmosphere was good, nobody posh, everybody having a laugh. We had a record player on all day. After about 2 years, I got enough money from that job, and we got married, and I went temporary. That was a copy typing job, secretary's work. It was a nice boss and nice girls. I was temporary, and this other girl had this position, and she kept having time off, and they put me in her position and made me permanent. That made me feel good. He made me permanent, that's right, and then just a month after he made me permanent, I got pregnant and had to leave anyway. I didn't want to give up work. Well, I wanted to give up for the reason that I was having a baby, but otherwise I didn't. I missed it, not at first because there was a lot to do with the baby, but afterwards. I've often felt I'd like to be back at work since. That was the 4 years between leaving school and having Karen. I haven't worked properly since then, although I've tried to do typing at home. It was ridiculous what you had to do to make up the money, and there was a lot of rushing about getting the work. I wouldn't work at the moment. I wouldn't put Stephen anywhere. I'd wait till he was at school. 2 years to go. I wouldn't want anyone else bringing them up because I've seen too many children put out. I just don't believe in it. My husband does deliveries for a building firm. His day starts early, sometimes at 6:30, sometimes at 5:30. He's back at 5:30 in the afternoon, except for when he does overtime, and then he isn't back till 9. Saturdays it's 8 till 1:30. It is supposed to be 8 in the week, but that's all overtime. He has to do that to make up his money to live and for this place. When he gets up, he puts the alarm on for me for 8. Sometimes I turn it off and lay there. Usually I get up. I come out here, go to the toilet, have a wash, and get the breakfast. They won't eat a cooked breakfast. She has cornflakes, and he has Weetabix. Karen dresses herself while I get the breakfast, and she has breakfast while I'm doing my hair. Some days before I go up to the school, if I get up earlier, I do the beds. Then I take her to school. It's just 2 doors down. Stephen stays asleep while I go. I leave the catch on the door, and my friend downstairs listens. Then I come back and get Stephen out of his cot and give him breakfast. I wash up. Then I wash these 2 floors first. Then I dress him. Then I do the bedroom, the front room, and the children's bedroom. Then I get on to the washing. I do the washing Monday and Friday. It takes about 1.5 hours. I aim to finish by 12 so I can meet Karen from school and she can come home and have some lunch. We have super scrambled eggs and a dinner at night. I never sit down in the morning. I never even have breakfast. I don't sit down till 4:30 when I watch Crossroads. In the afternoon, I usually go shopping. If I didn't, I might sit down with him, but I'd rather go out. I just go down the lane getting bits of dinner. I know near enough everybody around here. I go with either the friend downstairs or a friend up the road. Or I go to the clinic. In the summer, we walk to the Broadway and have dinner in Miller's department store. I do see people most days, more so since Karen went to school, because I meet the girls up there. I've just met another friend, and I've been round to hers twice this week. She's just had a baby, and she was a bit fed up. Other days, I just meet Karen from school, come back, wash the net curtains, do the ironing or something. Karen comes home at 3:30. She has juice and a biscuit, and they watch the children's programs on TV. Then my friend comes up, or we go down there and have dinner, have coffee, and watch Crossroads. I start dinner at 5. Then I get cleared up in here till about 7 o'clock. Then I wash the children. I put Stephen to bed first. Karen has to stay up because I daren't put them down together. She goes to bed about 7:30 or 8 when Stephen's asleep. That's every day, really. I do the same things in the same order every day. Stupid, isn't it? I do housework the same on Saturday and Sunday. I'm a fanatic for housework. I dust, go around with the carpet sweeper, and wash these two floors every day. The only thing I don't do the same is I don't do the stairs and I don't polish properly on a Saturday and a Sunday, because he's home and he don't like it. He can't bear me doing housework. He goes potty with me. He gets in a temper. When he's here, I try to leave it, but I do keep looking at it and wishing I could get up and do it. The interviewer asked her, "Do you like housework?" "I don't mind housework, really. It all depends how I feel. Sometimes I really like doing housework. I mean, enjoy doing housework, and other times, if he's carrying on, I hate doing it. I mind doing it when I'm pregnant. I thought I was pregnant this week, and I didn't want to do anything. But I'm all right, so I'm enjoying it. I must say I hate rushing housework. My husband might come home, say, now, and want egg and bacon, and I get in a temper because I've got to stop doing my work. I don't like being interrupted. Most mornings he comes in for breakfast like that. He'll come up in his big hobnail boots when I'm washing the floors. I like shopping if I've plenty of money. That isn't very often. If I've got to go around and look for cheap stuff, I don't like it. I like cooking. My friend and I try new recipes off the Jimmy Young show and have a laugh. We don't do it together, but we do it the same day and see what it turns out like. I get fed up with the same old things. I don't like washing up, and I always try to get my husband to wash up, but he won't most of the time. Washing I hate. This machine has a nasty habit of emptying onto the floor, and there's water all over the floor by the time I've finished, so I have to wash the floor again. Stephen puts things in the water, too. I don't like ironing. Well, I don't mind if I'm talking to someone while I'm doing it, but I don't like ironing when I'm just standing there doing it. But generally, I don't really know whether I like housework. I just do it. I can't say I like washing floors, kneeling on the floors, washing them. Not really. I do it to keep clean. Stephen's all over the floor, and if they're not done, he's going to get filthy. These floors are terrible. They show every mark. It's just routine, I suppose. It's just a habit. I know my mom always used to wash her floors every day. It's just a thing I've always done since I've been married. I don't know why. I feel it ought to be done. I've never been able to go out and leave anything. I could never leave washing up in the sink or anything like that. My mother's exactly the same.
The words to this song were found in a diary where so much of women's history and literature have been written. The author, Sarah Price, was a housewife living in Illinois around the time of the Civil War.
One day I was walking, I heard a complaining, I saw an old woman, the picture of gloom. She gazed at the mud on her doorstep, 'twas raining, and this was her song as she wielded her broom.
This is fictional. That was the story of a real housewife. This is a piece of fiction, contemporary fiction. Janine wakes from a dream. She has to go to her brother's this week. Everything suggests to Janine something she has lost, although she doesn't put it to herself this way. What she understands is that everything in the world wears a faint coating of nostalgia, makes her cry, seems to say to her, "You can't." She's fond of not being able to do things. Somehow this gives her a right to something. Her eyes fill with tears. Everything's a cheat. If she gets up right now, she'll be able to make the early bus. She also wants to get away from the dream that still lingers in the fold of her bedclothes, in the summery smell of her soft old sheets, a smell of herself that Janine likes but wouldn't admit to anybody. The bed is full of dreamy, suspicious hollows. Janine yawns out of a sense of duty. She gets up and makes the bed, then picks paperback books up off the floor, murder mysteries, and puts them away in her bookcase. There are clothes to wash before she goes, clothes to put away, stockings to pair and put in the drawers. She wraps the garbage in newspaper and carries it down 3 flights to put it in the garbage can. She routs Cal's socks from under the bed and shakes them out, leaving them on the kitchen table. There are dishes to wash, soot on the windowsill, soaking pots to scour, a dish to put under the radiator in case it goes on during the week. It leaks. Oh, ugh. Let the windows go, though Cal doesn't like them dirty. That awful job of scrubbing out the toilet, whisk-brooming the furniture. Clothes to iron. Things always fall out off when you straighten other things. She bends and bends. Flour and sugar spill on the shelves over the sink and have to be mopped up. There are stains and spills, rotting radish leaves, and encrustations of ice inside the old refrigerator. It has to be propped open with a chair to defrost itself. Odds and ends of paper, candy, cigarettes, cigarette ashes all over the room. Everything has to be dusted. She decides to do the windows anyway because it's nice. They'll be filthy in a week. Of course, nobody else helps. Nothing is the right height. She adds Cal's socks to her clothes and his clothes that she has to take to the self-service laundry, makes a separate pile of his clothes that have to be mended, and sets the table for herself. She scrapes old food from her cat's dish into the garbage, washes the dish, and sets out new water and milk. Mr. Frosty doesn't seem to be around. Under the sink, Janine finds a dishcloth, hangs it up over the sink, reminds herself to clean out under there later, and pours out cold cereal, tea, toast, orange juice. The orange juice is a government package of powdered orange and grapefruit and tastes awful. She jumps up to rummage around for the mop head under the sink and the galvanized pail also somewhere down in there. Time to mop the bathroom floor and the square of linoleum in front of the sink and stove. First she finishes her tea, leaves half the orange and grapefruit juice making a face and some of the cereal. Milk goes back in the refrigerator. No, wait a minute. Throw it out. She sits down for a moment and writes out a list of groceries to buy on the way back from the bus in a week. Fill the pail, find the soap, give up, mop it anyway with just water. Put everything away. Do the breakfast dishes. She picks up a murder mystery and sits on the couch, riffling through it. Jump up, wash the table, pick up the salt that falls on the rug, and brush it up with the whisk broom. Is that all? No. Mend Cal's clothes and her own. Oh, let them be. She has to pack and make her lunch in Cal's, though he's not going with her. That means things coming out of the icebox again and mopping the table again, leaving footprints on the linoleum again. Well, it doesn't matter. Wash the knife and the plate. Done. She decides to go get the sewing box to do his clothes and changes her mind. Instead, she picks up the murder mystery. Cal will say, "You didn't sew my clothes." She goes to get the sewing box out of the back of the closet, stepping over her valises, boxes of stuff, the ironing board, her winter coat and winter clothes. Little hands reach out of Janine's back and pick up what she drops. She sits on her couch, fixing the rip in his summer suit jacket, biting off the thread with her front teeth. He'll chip the enamel. Buttons, mending 3 socks, the others seem all right. Rubbing the small of her back. Fastening the lining of a skirt where it's torn. Inspecting her stockings for runs, polishing shoes. She pauses and looks at nothing. Then she shakes herself and with an air of extraordinary energy gets her middling-sized valise from the closet and starts laying out her clothes for the week. Cal won't let me smoke. He really cares about me. With everything cleaned up, she sits and looks at her room. The post says you should get cobwebs off the ceiling with a rag tied to a broom handle. Well, I can't see them. Janine wishes for the she doesn't know how many times that she had a real apartment with more than one room, though to decorate it properly would be more than she could afford. There's a pile of home decorating machines in the back of the closet, although that was only a temporary thing. The thought doesn't really recur to her much. Cal doesn't understand about such things. Tall, dark, and handsome. She refused her lover, the noble thing, mimosa and jasmine. She thinks how it would be to be a mermaid and decorate a merhouse with seaweed and slices of pearl. The mermaid's companion. The mermaid's home journal. She giggles. She finishes packing her clothes, taking out a pair of shoes to polish them with a bottle of neutral polish, because you have to be careful with the light colors. As soon as they dry, they'll go back in the valise. Trouble is, though, the valise is bloody well falling apart at the seams. Cal, when he comes, we'll find her reading Mademoiselle Mermaid about the new fish scale look for eyes. That was, as I said, from a contemporary novel. I am not going to identify the author right now. I may, if you know who it is, hang on to that. Hang on to that knowledge. This is a short story. It's a 19th century short story by a woman writer who was a scandal in her time. It's a we would call it now a short story. It's called The Story of an Hour. Knowing that Mrs. Mallard was afflicted with a heart trouble, great care was taken to break to her as gently as possible the news of her husband's death. It was her sister Josephine who told her in broken sentences, veiled hints that revealed and half-concealing. Her husband's friend Richard was there too, near her. It was he who had been in the newspaper office when intelligence of the railroad disaster was received, with Brently Mallard's name leading the list of killed. He had only taken the time to assure himself of its truth by a second telegram, and had hastened to forestall any less careful, less tender friend in bearing the sad message. She did not hear the story as many women have heard the same, with a paralyzed inability to accept its significance. She wept at once with sudden wild abandonment in her sister's arms. When the storm of grief had spent itself, she went away to her room alone. She would have no one follow her. There stood facing the open window a comfortable, roomy armchair. Into this she sank, pressed down by a physical exhaustion that haunted her body and seemed to reach into her soul. She could see in the open square before her the tops of trees that were all aquiver with the new spring life. The delicious breath of rain was in the air. In the street below, a peddler was crying his wares. The notes of a distant song which someone was singing reached her faintly, and countless sparrows were twittering in the eaves. There were patches of blue sky showing here and there through the clouds that had met and piled one above the other in the west facing her window. She sat with her head thrown back upon the cushion of the chair, quite motionless, except when a sob came up into her throat and shook her, as a child who has cried itself to sleep continues to sob in its dreams. She was young, with a fair, calm face whose lines bespoke repression and even a certain strength. But now there was a dull stare in her eyes, whose gaze was fixed away off yonder on one of those patches of blue sky. It was not a glance of reflection, but rather indicated a suspension of intelligent thought. There was something coming to her, and she was waiting for it, fearfully. What was it? She did not know. It was too subtle and elusive to name. But she felt it, creeping out of the sky, reaching toward her through the sounds, the scents, the color that filled the air. Now her bosom rose and fell tumultuously. She was beginning to recognize this thing that was approaching to possess her, and she was striving to beat it back with her will, as powerless as her two white slender hands would have been. When she abandoned herself, a little whispered word escaped her slightly parted lips. She said it over and over under her breath. Free, free, free. The vacant stare and the look of terror that had followed it went from her eyes. They stayed keen and bright. Her pulses beat fast, and the coursing blood warmed and relaxed every inch of her body. She did not stop to ask if it were or were not a monstrous joy that held her. A clear and exalted perception enabled her to dismiss the suggestion as trivial. She knew that she would weep again when she saw the kind, tender hands folded in death, the face that had never looked save with love upon her, fixed and gray and dead. But she saw beyond that bitter moment a long procession of years to come that would belong to her absolutely, and she opened and spread her arms out to them in welcome. There would be no one to live for her during those coming years. She would live for herself. There would be no powerful will bending hers in that blind persistence with which men and women believe they have a right to impose a private will upon a fellow creature. A kind intention or a cruel intention made the act seem no less a crime, as she looked upon it in that brief moment of illumination, and yet she had loved him sometimes. Often she had not. What did it matter? What could love, the unsolved mystery, account for in face of this possession of self-assertion, which she suddenly recognized as the strongest impulse of her being? Free. Body and soul free, she kept whispering. Josephine was kneeling before the closed door with her lips to the keyhole, imploring for admission. Louise, open the door, I beg. Open the door. You'll make yourself ill. What are you doing, Louise? For heaven's sake, open the door. Go away. I am not making myself ill. No, she was drinking in a very elixir of life through that open window. Her fancy was running riot along those days ahead of her. Spring days and summer days and all sorts of days that would be her own. She breathed a quick prayer that life might be long. It was only yesterday she had thought with a shudder that life might be long. She arose at length and opened the door to her sister's importunities. There was a feverish triumph in her eyes, and she carried herself, unwittingly, like a goddess of victory. She clasped her sister's waist, and together they descended the stairs. Richards stood waiting for them at the bottom. Someone was opening the front door with a latchkey. It was Brently Mallard who entered, a little travel-stained, composedly carrying his grip sack and umbrella. He had been far from the scene of accident and did not even know there had been one. He stood amazed at Josephine's piercing cry, at Richard's quick motion to screen him from the view of his wife. But Richard's was too late. When the doctors came, they said she had died of heart disease, of joy that kills.
It's sweeping at 6 and it's dusting at 7. It's fiddles at 8 and it's dishes at 9. It's potting and panning from 10 to 11. We scarce break our fast till we start into dine. Life is a toil, love is a trouble. Beauty will fade and riches will flee. Pleasures they dwindle and prices they double. And nothing is as I would wish it to be. With grease and with grime from corner to center, forever at war and forever alert. No rest for a day lest the enemy enter. I spend my whole life in a struggle with dirt.
The phone number here is 371-5200, and if anybody knows who the authors were of those two pieces of fiction, I will let you announce it instead of me. I'm one of them. The first one is an important piece of women's contemporary science fiction, and the other one is by a writer who never got to be well known in her lifetime, whose only novel scandalized. You can figure from that short story she would have been a scandalous kind of writer. And when she wrote a novel, it was received with such outrage that she never wrote again. That's a sad story. I like that story. The phone number is 371-5200, and I'm curious about whether anyone knows who wrote those things. Okay, WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello, Judy.
Hi.
Hi, this is Helene.
Hi.
Hi, the last piece of stuff that you read was by Kate Chopin.
Yes. I said the name of the story. It's called The Story of an Hour, and the book she wrote that scandalized the World. I assume you know the name of that, too.
The Awakening.
Yeah.
I didn't hear, I just turned on the radio, but if you said something important, contemporary science fiction, could that have been Marge Percy?
No.
Oh, because I just read Woman at the Edge of Time, which was fantastic.
It's a good guess.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you anyway.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. No, it was not Marge Percy, and I'm not going to keep everybody waiting. It was Joanna Russ, and the book is The Female Man, and it's a, if you haven't read it, it's a book that, it startled me when I read it, and I thought that I was, that I had a long-standing science fiction sensibility and a long-standing ability to deal with different kinds of role concepts, but it's a kind of dazzling book. And it takes place in three different segments of time at the same time. And the part I read was the one closest to the real world. The women in it either are or not, are not different sort of incarnations of each other. There's a lot that's hard to tell in that book and a lot that's up to you. But it's that is by far one of the most ordinary passages in the book. I would like, before I go on, I'm going to be reading some more about a different kind of woman's work, about office work, and the thing that I noticed as I was getting these pieces ready to read was the difference between the way the women in the piece that I, the two pieces that I was reading about seem real supportive of each other. The women in the Kate Chopin piece and the woman describing her friends in the piece from Woman's Work. And it made me realize again the difference between the way women have always related to each other in a world that they create in certain ways. The world of housewifery, of being, it's a women's world in some ways, at least during the day, and the way women relate to each other in a world where they are secretaries and working for men, who's, well, you'll hear it.
Ain't never sat on no levee, but I sure can cry. Ain't never sat on no levee, but I sure can cry. Perched on a stoop, over my roof, wondering how them pigeons fly. And when death comes calling, you know I'm sure gonna die. I ain't no washerwoman, ain't got no scrub on my knees. No washerwoman, ain't got no scrub on my knees. Two-fisted Mr. Clean ran off with a man from Glad. He tied him up with a Bounty towel and put him in a hefty bag. And if they want white floors in heaven, you know Jesus gonna have to keep them clean. Can't make no donut, can't bake no cherry pie. dinners and fresh canned soup, and I like my potatoes fried. And the next man says, hey, Jelly Roll gets a whole damn oven in his eye. Send a postcard to Let's Make a Deal and win a fancy trip to Paris or Rome. And when death comes calling, well, maybe I won't be at home. When death comes calling, well, maybe I won't be at home.
There's a book called Pink Collar Workers, Inside the World of Women's Work by Louise Kapp Howe. This is from the section on office workers, and it's a joint interview with a mother and daughter. The daughter, Diane, said, "It's ironic. Here I give anything if I could afford to quit working for a few years, and my mother would give anything to continue working. So what happened? The exact opposite." The mother, Nora, said, "At first I was going to try to fight it, but then when I realized I was just another statistic to them, I stopped caring. The hell with them." The daughter said, "Not much she didn't care. After they retired her, she was depressed for months. She's only coming out of it now. Speaking for myself, I still enjoy my work. That's not why I wish I could leave. I'd like to have another baby, a daughter, if possible, before I'm too old. And I'd also like to spend more time with my sons before they're all grown up and don't need me. Don't let anyone tell you being a full-time working mother is all that easy." The mother, "The company doesn't make it any easier." The daughter said, "Oh, they're pretty understanding about a mother's problems, within limits. As long as you're not out too much. Lucky for me, my kids are so healthy, knock wood. Cold, something minor, they can stay by themselves or I'll get a sitter. Only twice there's been a serious problem, both with my oldest. Pneumonia once and then a broken leg. Naturally, both times I felt I had to be with him, so that since they don't let you use your sick days for your children, I had to take my vacation days instead. Either that or be docked." The mother said, "So 2 years straight she missed her vacation." Diane said, "Mother's just bitter because she feels the company betrayed her, forcing her to retire, and then, as she'll tell you, her pension turned out to be lower than she had expected. But most of the time she was there, she thought it was a wonderful place to work. It was she who encouraged me to apply for a job, too." Nora said, "I know, it's true. I used to think it was wonderful. That's how much I knew. Diane was still in high school when I started. My other kids were grown. I thought I'd have no trouble finding a job. I had worked in offices before, and I could still type very well, and I knew quite a bit about bookkeeping. I thought I was a great catch." "Until she started looking," says her daughter. "The employment agencies, God bless them, warned me not to expect too much at my age, which at the time was 50. They said employers wanted sexy-looking girls, and besides, they were afraid of having to pay benefits to older women like me. All my past experience counted for very little. You may laugh, but I remember being mainly upset by that remark about sexy girls. I had gotten all gussied up, a new dress, new shoes, new hairdo. I had lost 10 pounds. I thought I was sexy. I hadn't realized I was a zero because I was 50. Then someone asked if I'd be willing to take something part-time for a while. That's how I got started at the company. They put me in the actuarial department where they have a number of part-timers as well as temps, and after a while they put me on full-time. And as I say, I loved it. The actuarial department, that's the brains of the insurance business, you know. You have to understand your concepts very well. Cash values, premiums, dividends, everything under the sun. I was a calculator, a human calculator. And I was as content as can be until they started giving everything to the computers." The daughter said, "After my high school graduation, I came straight to the company. I started as a file clerk, like those students in that ceremony you saw. And then they transferred me to personnel, where my job was helping to get information about employees for the IBM cards, adding up dependents, figuring out benefits. I liked it very much, very much. Then the next year, I married Bob, who's from Norway, and we went back there to live for several years, during which time I had my two kids. The mother. The computers changed everything for me. Ask the other old-timers in my department. I think they'll tell you the same thing. Before, we were used to doing perfect work, careful work. We took pride. I remember when they started making the changeover. Instead of asking our advice, the men programmed it themselves, and for months afterwards, everything was coming out wrong. I told them, look, if you put garbage in, you'll get garbage out. So then one of the young executives, half my age, said I should realize that there were four things you needed in order to be a good calculator. Facts, figures, accuracy, and speed. I said I agreed with everything but the speed. Why was that so important? A human calculator can never beat the speed of a machine, but we can be as accurate. We can give personal service. But speed is what comes first today, whatever that man told you about job enrichment. The daughter said, when my husband and I came back to America, it was a hard time for us. The babies were small, and no one wanted to hire him, a foreigner, even though he speaks English very well. So we moved in with my parents, and Bob took care of the kids for almost a year until he was finally able to get work, and I went back to the company. It was a necessity for me to work, but to tell you the truth, I probably would have been bored at home at the time, which may surprise you after what I said before about wishing I could leave now. But you see, then we were living in an old neighborhood. There weren't many women my age. There wouldn't have been anything much to do outside. But now where I live, it's totally different. There are so many activities I'd like to be involved in, scouting, gardening, our PTA. I believe in parent involvement in the schools, but right now I simply don't have the time. That's my main problem, time. The same with most of the mothers with small children I work with. Just finding the time to do all the things you have to do, let alone time for yourself. The mother said, I was with the company not quite 15 years when I left this past April. That was exactly 1 month after my 65th birthday, which is the longest they allow you to stay. Then I learned, as Diane said, that my pension wasn't going to be nearly as much as I had assumed, had planned. Thank God my husband is collecting his own pension. Honestly, I don't know how the single women and the widows are managing. You know, once a few years ago, I complained to personnel that the pension plan wasn't fair to women. Men got much more. A year later, they equalized it. By guess what? By lowering the men to the women. Not raising us to their level. So now we can't complain about discrimination with the pensions. We're all low. Except, of course, the higher your salary, the higher your pension. And the men are, of course, usually far, far higher. This is WBAI in New York.
Change up.